I'm sort of debating what to call this episode. And the title of your book is so great. It's Who Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. And I kind of want to call it Anne Curzan Says. That's who. Does that seem right?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 18th year, number 920, Anne Curzan Says. Anne Curzan is the professor of English linguistics and education and the dean of the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts at the University of Michigan. And her new book, Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words, is exactly what it says. A fun and lively conversation about language and the kinds of rules that are helpful and the kind you can ignore. Anne also hosts That's What They Say, the weekly podcast about linguistics and the history of language from Michigan Public Radio. So I was thrilled to have her join me on my podcast. We began our conversation with Anne explaining why she's reluctant to have me title this episode, Anne Curzan Says.
That might come across as a bit prescriptive of me telling people how to think, but I certainly am encouraged. Anne Curzan says, ask a lot of questions.
You give us all a great clue with the title. You've put the word funner into the title, which is so great. And it is, in fact, one of the most funner books on language I've ever read. So mission accomplished in every way.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. And people sometimes ask me, why? As an English professor, Anne, did you put funner in the title of your usage guide? And it was first to say, this is designed to be fun. This isn't your typical usage guide, because I think that learning about language and the history of these rules and all of this trivia about where things came from and why things are the way they are, that it is fun. It meets a kind of human curiosity about language. Second, I thought people probably are going to be provoked and intrigued by a usage guide that puts funner in the subtitle. And then, of course, I had to follow through. So, as you know, there's a chapter called The Funnest Chapter.
And indeed it is. Well, and you chart really well where these quote unquote rules come from and how they have been codified, cauterized, fossilized into these hard, fast rules that were never possibly meant to be and that we can all loosen up, right?
That's right. I think that learning where these rules come from helps us contextualize what they may have originally been meant to do. And then we can have really smart conversations about usage, where rather than talking about what is quote unquote right, and what is quote unquote wrong, because as a linguist, I would say it's not nearly that easy. We can talk about, for this audience, in this context, given my purpose as a speaker and writer, what is going to be the most rhetorically effective way to use language? And what you discover is that some of these rules are helpful. They reduce ambiguity, they promote clarity, and particularly in writing, that is really helpful. And then some of these rules are not helpful.
At all, ever.
Yeah. Right. And it's useful to distinguish between those two.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I think that it's so practical, the advice that you give, because sometimes you're writing for an audience that wants you to be strict. And sometimes you're not. And I know in my own writing, I'm frequently writing for audiences who expect something, and I want to give them something else because it'll be funny or effective in some other way.
Or provocative.
Yes.
In a way that you are choosing to do. And what I love about your example is that it captures you making rhetorical choices about what language do I want to use here toward particular ends? And yeah. I've spent my career as an English professor, and I feel like that's my job, is to make sure that students have as big a linguistic and rhetorical toolbox as I can give them, and the kind of meta knowledge about which tools do I want to pull out at which moments, because this is what I'm trying to achieve. And I will say that's not the way I was taught grammar and usage.
Yeah.
It's not the way a lot of usage guides come at it, but students find it so much more engaging and fun and empowering to think about language that way.
Well, and I would think they find it far less intimidating. And if they've had any instruction in this regard, probably really far more refreshing.
I couldn't have put it better. And the thing I would add is that it takes them and their language seriously.
Yes.
So that the changes that they're introducing into the language, because of course, young people are, as one linguist puts it, the movers and shakers of language change. It says, you're not wrong. You're on the cutting edge of language.
Yeah, that's right. You are the first responders of what's going on out there. Well, and you frame the book in a really funnest way. As a kind of epic Titanic battle between your inner wordy and your inner grammando. Can you define your terms? Because I hear grammando, and I think that has something to do with underwear.
Well, and then you can have the phrase to go grammando on someone.
Well, exactly.
Exactly. So this was such an interesting and rewarding part of writing the book, was that I came to this framing in the writing of the book. Grammando is a term that I was introduced to by Lizzie Skernick in the New York Times Sunday Magazine in the little column, That Should Be a Word. Yeah. And it was 2012, and she had grammando, and the definition was someone who constantly corrects someone else's grammar.
Right.
And I thought, I love that word, because that is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the words that we have for it, I don't particularly like. So we tend to use either grammar police or grammar Nazi.
Yeah.
And I don't love throwing around Nazi in places where we're trying to be funny or playful or metaphorical. So grammando.
You make a great point about that too. If we're going to talk about Nazis, let's talk about Nazis. You know, let's not normalize. I am so guilty of using that phrase, but I totally agree about that grammando is a more better way of saying it.
Way of saying that. And then you get the phrase that someone goes grammando on someone else, which is a phenomenon, and it's nice to have a term for that.
Yeah.
So that's the one. And then wordy, which is also a relatively new word. It got into Merriam-Webster's dictionaries in 2018, defined as a lover of words, like a foodie for words.
Yeah.
And the insight in writing the book was that it's not just that these are kinds of people, but that actually, I think every single one of us, as you said, in our head has an inner grammando and an inner wordy who are both reacting to language.
Yeah.
And that I'm trying to encourage them to have a more informed conversation in our heads. And so it was in part to normalize, I'm a linguist. I study language change and language variation for a living. I love language change. It keeps me in business. Super helpful.
Right.
But I still have, so my inner wordy is really powerful. It has a big microphone. It has a lot of information at its disposal, has a lot to say. But I still have an inner grammando that will sometimes hear something in the language, a new change, and it will get cranky. It will say, I don't like that.
Mm.
And so then I need to step back and say, okay, Anne's inner grammando, how well formed is that opinion?
Yeah.
And does it just mean that I'm going to opt out? I don't like that word and I'm going to opt out of using it because for whatever reason, I don't like it. But because I don't have good grounds for that, I'm not going to correct it in other people because it's just my thing. And a great example is the word impactful, which is new in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, Anne Curzan heard that word and decided that she found it aesthetically displeasing.
Right.
So, and I was giving a talk the other day and I said, you know, I don't like the word impactful. And this young person, probably 13, 14, just looked at me and he said, why? What's your problem? And I said, I don't have a good reason for this. I just don't like it and I will get over it or I won't, but the word will succeed. It already is succeeding and it doesn't matter actually whether I like it or not.
Well, I love two things about that. I love that that person called you on it and I love that you took it. Yeah. All right. Fair note. Yeah. I think impactful as a synonym for effect. Yeah. Is that what we're talking about?
Impactful as a synonym for significant, having great, high impact.
Oh, that's right. You were talking about impact as a verb.
The verb. That's been a peeve for quite a while.
Yeah. And impact versus effect, yes. I think. I don't think you mentioned this in the book, but that made sense to me because I am constantly going, which effect do I need? Do I want here? Affect or effect?
That I love that point. I don't mention in the book, but impact as a verb helps you get out of the affect effect conundrum.
Right.
And it is a conundrum because, of course, they both can be verbs because you can effect change, but you can also affect people with an A. Yeah, so impact gets you out of it.
Hi, I'm Nicole Galland, author of the novels I, Iago and The Rise and Fall of Dodo, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This fall of 2024, we'll be performing the special election edition of The Complete History of America Abridged in Illinois, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Colorado. Check out the touring page at our website, ReduceShakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Anne Curzan, talking about her new book, Says Who? A kinder, funner usage guide for everyone who cares about words.
Can you tell me your superhero origin story? Didn't you begin in mathematics? Do I remember you saying that?
You're absolutely right. And I talk with undergraduates about this a lot because they often come into college saying, I'm going to major in this and minor in this, and I know exactly what I'm going to do. And I say, if you'd asked me this in the first month of college, I would have said, I'm a math major. Right. And I was a mathy kid who was interested in languages, didn't really know what linguistics was. And I took a linguistics course my first year in college, really liked it. And then my sophomore year, I took a course on the history of the English language, and I fell in love. I thought it was the coolest thing. Here was this professor, Marie Borroff, who knew the answers to the questions that I hadn't known were the questions that I was the most curious about. So when was double negation standard in English? Did Shakespeare really make up all those words? Why is colonel spelled with an L and pronounced with an R? Where did the U in 40 go? She knew the answers to those questions, and I have been pursuing questions like that ever since college.
I love it. And I also love the expression mathy, the adjective mathy, because now that you're into language and talking about it, you've gone from mathy to mouthy in a positive, great way, which I like.
And the other thing that I discovered was really a good fit for me as a linguist is that language, there's a mathy part of language, that language is a system, the sound system, the grammatical system. And there are parts when you're teaching the sound system, I have charts and equations on the board. And some of my students are looking at that going, that looks a lot like math. So the math part of my brain really enjoys that. And then language is quirky and creative and fundamentally human. And the humanistic part of my brain loves the creativity and the ways in which we both make the language more systematic in some places and introduce irregularities in other places. That's one of the joys of studying language.
You make a great example in the book about, in terms of people approaching language as you might approach being a bird watcher, which I think is so brilliant. Can you explain that?
Thank you for the question, because this was, again, something that I came to in writing the book. And for those of us who write, it's one of the joys of writing is that you figure things out as you write them, and it clarifies your thinking, and sometimes you come to new insights. And as I was working on this book, and I was thinking about what I was really trying to say to people about how to think about language variation and change, I sort of got to this, you know, the new birds of language, that here's this fascinating new bird, and think about yourself as a birder or a bird watcher. And when you hear or see something new, either because it's new in the language or because it's part of a variety that you don't know, and so you're hearing it for the first time, approach it like a birder. Think, what is that? How does it work? Where does it come from? What colorful feathers it has? You know, describe it, be curious about it, figure out where it comes from, as opposed to what our inner grammandos sometimes do when the inner grammando hears something new and it thinks, kill it.
Yes, that's exactly what happens. And why would you do that? Why should that be your impulse? Exactly.
And if it is your impulse, okay, then take a beat. Let your inner wordy have a moment to step in there and say, are we being a birder right now?
Right. Or just completely own it and admit you're a horrible person.
Or at least admit you have a peeve about that thing.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Anne Curzan's new book, Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words, is available everywhere, and you can find her weekly podcast, That's What They Say, wherever you get your podcasts. Send us your grammar peeves via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks as always to nerdy, wordy Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Jimmy McGuire. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to New York Times bestselling author Nicole Galland, whose new novel, Boy, about Shakespeare's star boy actor, is available for pre-order now. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 920/2760 of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
And thank you so much for this really, really good conversation. Honestly, I think it's the goodest conversation I've had all week.
I love your inner wordy coming out to play.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less. So much less. So much less.